You're listening to TIP.
On today's show, we have a discussion about the wealthiest person on the entire planet, Mr. Jeff Bezos. As everyone knows, Jeff is the founder of Amazon and numerous other subsidiaries. The amazing thing about Amazon and Jeff's rise to the top is it all happened within the last 20 years. Jeff grew Amazon from the ground up, and today his personal net worth is $143 billion. So just to put that in perspective, Jeff could spend $392,000 every single day for the next 1,000 years before he'd run out of money. And that's also assuming that he makes no interest on that money during that 1,000 years. So during the interview, we play some of his responses to various interview questions, and we cover a wide array of topics to include even his thoughts on space and his company Blue Origin. Additionally, Stig was out on travel, so my good friend Brian Rutherford filled in for him. Brian is a former instructor of economics at West Point, and he's a graduate of MIT. So without further delay, here's our discussion around the ideas of Jeff Bezos.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
All right. So welcome to the Investors Podcast. Like I said in the introduction, I'm here with my good friend, Brian Rutherford. And Brian, great to have you back on the show again, man.
Hey, great to be back with you, Preston.
So we're going to be talking about Jeff Bezos. Everyone, I'm sure, listening to this knows who Jeff Bezos is. So without going into all the background and slowing things down, let's just talk about the first question that we're going to play here. The question that Jeff was asked was, when did you know that Amazon is going to be way bigger than just a bookstore? And this is his response.
Well, I knew that the books, strangely, because I was very prepared for this to take a really long time. I knew that the books business was going to be successful in the first 30 days. Mm-hmm. I was shocked at how many books we sold. We were ill prepared. We had only 10 people in the company at that time, and most of them were software engineers. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, including me and the software engineers, were all like packing boxes. We didn't even have packing tables. And down, we were on our hands and knees on a concrete floor packing the boxes. And at about, 1 or 2 in the morning, I said to one of my software engineering colleagues, I said, Paul, this is killing my knees. We need to get knee pads. And Paul looked at me and he's like, Jeff, we need to get packing tables. And I was like, oh my God, that is such a good idea. The next day I bought packing tables and it doubled our productivity and probably saved our backs and our knees too.
So for me, I mean, there's not too much to really add to what he's saying here other than it's just crazy to think that this guy was packing books himself from the ground up from the very beginning. We had Ian Siegel on the show, Brian. I don't know if you heard this interview, the guy from ZipRecruiter. And the thing that he told us, he says, if you have something that is going to be big, he's like, you're going to know right away. It's not something that's going to just like kind of start coming into play 3 years later. He's like, you'll know right out of the gate if you've got something big. So I'm kind of curious if you have any piggyback comments on this one.
First of all, I think entrepreneurs absolutely believe in themselves. They believe in their ability to find a market and exploit a niche in it. And I think that that's what Jeff was saying here, right? But it goes back to risk. I think about business plans, and you and I both went through an MBA experience, and a lot of times business plans get laughed at as not worth the paper they're written on. But it's not about the plan. It's the planning that goes into it, right? So Jeff understood at that point, he had done the market analysis and understood that if you put a bunch of SKUs in one location and then shipped out from there, that was going to be a whole lot better position and really able to exploit this new thing called the internet in 1995 versus having distributed points of sale. And what the one thing he didn't know is timing. Was it the right time for that business? And he said, yes, he knew within 30 days.
Hey, I want to check out this question where he was asked, how has your leadership style changed over the years? I think this would be kind of interesting to hear.
It's changed a lot, mostly just because it's had to. You know, the company has changed so much, and I can't, you know, when the company is 10 people or 100 people, I can be involved in every decision, not just, you know, not just the objectives, like what are we going to do, but even the methods, how are we going to do it? You know, the CEO or the founder or whoever it is leading the company cannot be involved in all of those decisions. They certainly cannot be involved in the methods of how things are going to get done. So you do have to change your leadership approach as the company scales. But the principles of the company have not changed. In fact, I probably spend more of my time now on culture and trying to set high standards for things like customer obsession and inventiveness and things like that. So for me, I'm kind of a teacher now, so it's changed quite a bit. And I have this great luxury. I love my job. I tap dance into work. Even I just got back from an amazing vacation in Norway. I got to go dog sledding and go to a wolf preserve and all this really cool stuff. But I couldn't wait to get back to work because it's so fun. And the reason, one of the reasons it's fun for me is I get to work in the future. So my job, I have very limited kind of day-to-day operational needs. That, you know, I've constructed my job so that I don't have to be pulled into the present. I can stay 2 or 3 years in the future. And actually, I'm always advising my senior team, the people who report to me, that they should organize themselves in the same way. We're big enough now that they need to be able to look around corners. They can't be, if something pulls me into the present, it's because something has gone wrong. You know, and we need to, you know, kind of figure, it's a firefighting exercise. And that's not how you should be running a business of this scale. So it's changed a lot.
I don't know. I find that response pretty interesting because it's so much different than the Buffett style approach that we are constantly studying. I know Buffett, he's trying to figure out the valuation of a business based off the free cash flows into the future and kind of understanding what the assets, how durable those assets are and whether they'll be impaired into the future. But it seems like Bezos is trying to invent the future, and it's where his primary focus is at almost all the time. Like, he's totally hired somebody else to take care of the day-to-day operations because he doesn't even want to think about it, which I also find fascinating. The one thing in there that I really liked, Brian, was he was talking about how much of his time is consumed into the culture. And then he made that statement, customer obsession. He said customer obsession after he was talking about the culture that he's trying to groom there. So, like, for me, that's like a slip of his like secret sauce. And anybody who's studied Bezos a little bit knows that it's like he basically has the chair at the conference room that's empty, and supposedly the customer's sitting in there, and everyone has to, you know, ask the customer a question to the empty chair or whatever. But I mean, really, that's his secret sauce. He wants customers to be obsessed with his brand, and if it doesn't create that obsession, he doesn't do it. So,
yeah, no, you're exactly right. He focuses on the customer and not the competitor. This is what Apple did as well. Give the customer what they want before they know they want it. So, yeah, I think that strategic thinking, looking around the corners, I think was key. And I also think, you know, think about how he focuses on the important but not urgent, right? So there's this famous like quadrant of things where you have urgent on one axis and important and not important on the other axis. And so which quadrant do you want to be in? And I think about the important but not urgent, because if you don't focus there, everything will end up in the important and urgent quadrant, and you'll spend all your time, as he says, putting out fires. That's really, really key, I think.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third-generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The Holy Grail of Investing, the new book by Tony Robbins and co-written by investing legend Christopher Zook, reveals the secrets of alternative investments like private equity, venture capital, energy, real estate, sports franchises, and more. It features exclusive insights from investing titans who collectively manage more than $500 billion, including Robert F. Smith, Vinod Khosla, Michael B. Kim, and many others. In The Holy Grail of Investing, you'll discover how to take advantage of the trillions flowing into private equity by becoming an owner of firms that actually manage the assets and share in the revenue they generate, how to take advantage of the 2 to 3 times higher returns of private credit as an alternative or complement to bonds, how to invest in the energy evolution and ride the wave of trillions in global investments, how investments in private real estate can work as an inflationary hedge and source of tax-efficient income, and how many of the world's greatest investors thrive in both good times and bad. The Holy Grail of Investing by Tony Robbins is available now wherever books are sold.
All right, back to the show.
So the next one that I want to talk about here is something that's a little outdated, but I think that it's an interesting conversation to listen to this. He was asked, and this was played. Do you remember when this was played, Brian? It was,
yeah, it was 2014, late in 2014.
Yeah. 2014, this was played, and he was asked, you know, your company's not profitable. Does that bother you when people say your company's not profitable? And this is his response. And why this is a little outdated is because, you know, Amazon's obviously making some net income at this point, but it's not huge relative to their top line revenue. If you're looking at it proportionally, it's not huge. He's bringing in some earnings, but even now it's still kind of hit or miss sometimes. So I think this is an interesting question just to hear his mindset and how he thinks about this stuff. So that's why we're going to play this one.
Warren Buffett has this great quote. He says, you can hold a rock concert and that's okay. And you can hold a ballet, and that's okay. Just don't hold a rock concert and advertise it as a ballet. Investors come in all shapes and sizes. They have different investment horizons, different approaches, different beliefs about what the right kind of portfolio looks like. And so it's not one, you know, people use Wall Street as a shorthand, but there isn't one type of investor. They come in all shapes and sizes. And you have to be super clear about what kind of company you're trying to build, what your approach is. We laid that out in our 1997 annual shareholder letter. We said we were going to take big bets. We said they were going to fail. We said some of them hopefully were going to work. We said we were going to invest for the long term, that we were going to try to take advantage of market opportunities as they arose. And there's a certain kind of investor who is aligned with that approach. And so, again, you can hold the ballet or the rock concert, and both can work. Just be clear about which one you are, and then people can self-select. I would say, you know, it's very difficult for a publicly traded company to switch. So if you've been holding a rock concert and then you want to have a ballet, that transition is going to be difficult. But if you've done it from the very beginning, and then I think it's not that difficult to do. We would all love all of our numbers to be smooth lines up and to the right, and that would be terrific, but that's not how it works. You know, those numbers are output measures. And I guess you could try to manage your quarterly earnings very precisely, but I think personally that would be a mistake. You know, most of the work that we put into any particular quarter happened years ago. So it's not, you know, there aren't that many knobs you can turn during a quarter. I mean, you can, but they're like eating your seed corn if you turn those knobs. You don't want to do that. And so I think if you focus on the controllable inputs to your business instead of the outputs, in the long term, you get better results. So the Benjamin Graham quote here is that in the short term, the stock market is a voting machine. In the long term, it's a weighing machine. And I think people are well advised to build a company that wants to be weighed and not voted upon. And that means having good return on invested capital and having, you know, lots of free cash flow. But if you said to me, if I said, here's a job I would reject. If somebody came up to me and said, Jeff, I want your job to be to drive up the Amazon stock price and just manage that directly. Now, this might sound ridiculous to some of you, but many companies actually do this. They actually go out and they try to sell the stock. That's kind of the final output. And it's much better to say, okay, let's not do that. That's not going to be sustainable. It's kind of a silly approach. What are the inputs to a higher stock price? And you say, okay, well, free cash flow and return on invested capital are inputs to a higher stock price. Okay, so let's keep working backwards. What are the inputs to free cash flow? And you keep working backwards until you get to something that's controllable. And a controllable input for free cash flow would be something like lower cost structure. And then you back up from there and you say, okay, well, you know, if we can improve our picking efficiency in our fulfillment centers and reduce defects, defects are very, very costly. It's probably, you know, reducing defects at the root is one of the best ways to lower cost structure. And so if you then that starts to be a job you would accept. You would say, if you're, you know, a reasonable person, you would say, I have no idea how to drive up the stock price. I can't manage that directly. It's not a controllable input. But I can make your picking algorithms more efficient. And that will reduce cost structure. And then, you know, follow that chain all along the way. That's what you do in all of these businesses. You want, you know, customer obsession. You want to invent your way out of boxes. You want to invent your way into the future. You want to be patient. And you want to have operational excellence so that you're finding defects at the root and fixing them.
So that was some powerful stuff there. I love that last part where he's talking about what's your output versus what's your inputs. And it's funny how much, even in business schools, and Brian, I'm curious if you saw the same thing at MIT, but business schools focusing on the stock price and just looking at things from like the pure numbers on the financial statements, opposed to let's go and dig deeper. Well, what drives free cash flow? What drives this? And then ultimately arriving at, you have to be adding value to the customer. That's what he was really describing there at the end, is he's lowering his cost structure, which then that's being, you know, carried out to the customer, so they get lower prices and they're more satisfied relative to the competition. So love that discussion. I'm curious what some of the points you took out of it, Brian.
Yeah, first, clearly he's listening to your podcast, because he's talking about cash flow and return on invested capital as good measures of the health of the business. And he also, you know, he highlighted the lunacy kind of quarterly reports. Nobody does their business of quarterly reports, and even, you know, to some degree, annual reports. And that's what I heard at Sloan as well, is, you know, when the CEOs would come and talk to us, you know that it's there that they think about stock price, because in a lot of ways, and let's just be honest, that's how they're compensated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of really great points about investing for the future and that sort of thing. There was just a touch of selection bias here, right? We're listening to you know, an answer of Jeff Bezos here in 2018, and he was saying these, you know, grandiose things in 1997. Had none of that worked, we wouldn't be talking about Jeff Bezos right now. So. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a little bit of looking backward, you know, to look forward. So Yeah, some really great stuff, though, in terms of being, you know, guided by principles of long-term investing.
You know, the one thing that I think about whenever I hear that response, the first thing you think is, well, why are so many CEOs being driven by the stock price and not looking at it the same way that Jeff is describing it here? And the only thing that I can come up with is he has made his money, right? He's a major shareholder in Amazon. And so he's not looking for the bonus. He's not looking for the what. This guy's the wealthiest person on the planet. So he's just trying to create the best business possible. And I think when you go out there and you look at other businesses that do operate the way he's describing, oftentimes you find a similar situation where the CEO/founder owns 30% of the stock and is making decisions based on what he thinks is going to add the most customer value and what's best for the business, opposed to how can I get a $10 million bonus this year?
And sure, short versus long-term returns. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not guaranteed you're going to see that across similar structures, but I think that you find it more common in similar situations as what we just described as far as the governance of the business.
Yeah, you can focus on social impact and being a better citizen, and he'll talk a lot about that kind of stuff.
So here's an interesting question, because it's often brought up about his ownership of the Washington Post. And I found this really fascinating to hear his comments on this, because the question that was asked was, did you buy the Washington Post as a personal toy or just wanted to basically influence or put your political spin on things? Is that why you bought it? And this was his response.
You can explain things to people, but you can't understand things to people. And so all I can do is say what really my thought process was. And I was not looking to buy a newspaper. It had never even crossed my mind. And so when the opportunity came up, because I only came up because I had known Don Graham at that point for more than 15 years. Any of you who are lucky enough to know Don knows that he is the most honorable gentleman that you'll ever meet. He's a remarkable guy. And he so loved the Post that he believed, even though this was a huge personal sacrifice for him because it had been in his family for so long, that he needed to find a new home for it. There were certain purchasers he was hoping would not end up buying the Post because he wanted it to remain independent. Yeah. When he approached me with this, I said, you know, I'm the wrong guy because I don't know anything about the newspaper business. And he said, that's okay, because we have a lot of people at the Post who know a lot about the newspaper business. And what we really need is somebody who knows something more about the internet. The Post was in very difficult financial position at that time. And so for me, I had to decide, was it hopeless? And I didn't believe it was hopeless. Mm. I thought I was optimistic that the Post could be turned around. And then second, I had to decide, did I want to put my own time and energy into this? And that for me, I just had to ask the simple question, is it an important institution? And the answer to that question is yes. It was very obvious to me as soon as I thought about it that way. It's like, okay, I think I actually can help. I can help in two ways. I can provide financial resources while this turnaround occurs. And I can also help with my internet knowledge. And then is it an institution worth saving? You bet. It's the most important newspaper in the most important capital city in the Western world. Crazy not to save that newspaper. I'm going to be very happy when I'm 80 that I made that decision. The Post is it for me. I'm not interested in buying other newspapers. But I do. I watch that movie, and it's helpful. I love that movie, and also reading Katharine Graham's memoir, which won a Pulitzer Prize and is an amazing book, because it gets me ready. You know, I as the owner of the Post, I know that at times the Post is going to write stories that are going to make very powerful people very unhappy. I would be humiliated to interfere. I would be so embarrassed. I would turn bright red. And it has nothing to do with I don't even get so far. I just don't want to. For me, it would feel icky. It would feel gross. It would be one of those things when I'm 80 years old, I would be so unhappy with myself if I interfered. Why would I? Yeah. I want that paper to be independent. We have a fantastic editor in Marty Baron. We have a fantastic publisher in Fred Ryan. The head of our technology team, a guy named Shailesh, is fantastic. They don't need my help in the newsroom for sure. First of all, that's also an expert's job. It would be like me getting on the airplane and going up to the front of the plane and saying the pilots should move aside. Let me do this.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Ally, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. As many of you know, I love studying businesses and networking with business owners. The more I've studied businesses, the more I've realized that starting and scaling your business is easier than ever because of companies like Shopify. Did you know that Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify even helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. Up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. What I personally love about Shopify is that it's the turnkey solution to kickstart and grow your business, and they are totally committed to giving you the necessary tools to succeed as a business owner. Plus, they have an award-winning customer support team there to help you every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/WSB. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/WSB now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/WSB.
All right, back to the show.
So it's pretty interesting discussion to hear how that really unfolded. And it's just kind of like a family friend. He was friends with the owners and they wanted to offload it to the right person, and he was the guy. Now, what I think is admirable in the way that he looked at this is he asked himself, is this something that society should value? Is this something that's that adds value to society? And whenever he concluded yes, that weighed heavily in the way that he made his decision. And I find that really important. And I think that that's something that a lot of people maybe not know about the way that Jeff makes decisions on the types of businesses and assets that he purchases. Now, was that just because he was, you know, giving a presentation and in a brief swell? Maybe a little bit. I don't know. But I think that that's something that, I think that's something people should really think about whenever they're creating a new product or service.
Yeah. So perfect point. I mean, he really just highlights his thinking between short and long-term value to his customers, right? Because he modulated in his answer there from market opportunity. This opportunity came up, you know, I looked at it from, guiding values, point of view. And then he ended up talking about it as an institution and how he'd feel when he is 80 years old. And I think what he's talking about there is long-term value to society.
Okay, so for this next question, he's asked, how do you manage disparate businesses? And this was his response.
We do so many different things. So this is a question I sometimes get. How can you do so many different things? Why don't you stick to the knitting? The kind of traditional advice would be to stay focused and keep the business simple. And the way I think about this is we actually do stick to one thing. It's just not described. It's not the business itself. We do web services, which is, big enterprises buying compute services from us. And we have our retail business, and we have Amazon Studios, which is making original content, and Amazon Go, the things you listed. So, but the cultural thread that runs through all these things is the same. We only have a few principles at Amazon, kind of core values that we go back to over and over again. And if you looked at each of the things that we do, you would see those run straight through everything. So the first one, and by far the most important one, is customer obsession. And we talk about it as customer obsession as opposed to competitor obsession. And I have seen over and over again companies talk about that they're customer focused, but really when I pay close attention to them, I believe they are competitor focused. And that's just a completely different mentality. By the way, competitor focus can work, but I don't think it works in the long run as well as customer focused. For one thing, once you're the leader, if your whole culture is competitor obsessed, it's kind of hard to stay energized and motivated if you're out in front. Whereas customers are always unsatisfied, they're always discontent, they always want more. And so no matter how far you get out there in front of your competitors, you're still behind your customers. So they're always pulling you along. So customer obsession is a deep principle that underlies everything we do. Another one is eagerness to invent. So we love to pioneer. And when we have done, by the way, whenever we have tried to do something in a kind of Me Too fashion, we have failed at it. We need to have something that is differentiated, unique, something that customers are going to like, that we're kind of leading with. So that's another element that works for us. And then another one is long-term thinking. We are willing to take some time and be patient with our business initiatives, and that runs through everything. So a lot of our competitors might have 2 to 3 year kind of time frames, and we might have more of a 5 to 7 year sort of time frame. And then the last one, operational excellence. So literally, how do you have high standards around, identifying defects, fixing defects at the root, all of those kinds of things that lead to what I think also can be, in a simpler way, just stated as professionalism, that you want to do things right just for the sake of doing them right.
So I really liked that piece. And I liked how he said the part there about every time we've tried to compete with something that basically beat us to the punch or that created something before us, and then we try to bring something to market that competes with that, it's never really worked out too well for us. That is a really interesting statement because, I mean, they've got so many different products and so many different things on their, assets on their balance sheet. So for him to say that with the size of their balance sheet, I think that's really telling. And this really goes to, we've never covered this book on the show, but it's called Blue Ocean Strategy. It's a pretty popular book, but that's the whole premise of the Blue Ocean Strategy, is that you create your own stuff and you're not in this competition mode. You're more looking to satisfy the customer. Brian, I'm curious what some of the points you pulled out of there.
Yeah, I think he, just the way he frames it, is that we don't do lots of things. We do one thing. That one thing is comes down to customer obsession, eagerness to invent, you know, having that long-term vision. I mean, at the bottom line, they leverage a platform, and that platform is logistics. And so, you know, you just look at the day that they bought Whole Foods, or the day that that was announced, grocery chains were down 8 to 10% in their market cap. Think how much money was lost just because Amazon was going to take their platform and apply it to this new industry. I guarantee you, Jeff wasn't thinking about how can I be the best grocer. He was thinking about how do I use those guiding principles, that customer obsession, and really change the grocery experience.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm really excited that he basically broke out the four big rules for people to kind of hear how he analyzes pretty much everything that comes across his desk. And really, that's the culture. He's breeding those big four points into his culture for anybody that comes in and briefs something. I think that's a very keen insight and definitely worth writing down if you're creating your own business and think about that vantage point. Hey, so this next one, I don't know if your everyday entrepreneur might gain insights or whatever out of this one, but I just think it's cool. So I want to play this question. It relates to, he was asked, what in the world is Blue Origin up to? And for people that aren't familiar with this, Blue Origin is a space company. So he's going to talk about this in the next one.
Well, Blue Origin is, the vision for Blue Origin is millions of people living and working in space. And the key thing is we have to dramatically reduce the cost of access to space. Right now, space travel is very expensive. And the reason it's expensive is not hard to understand. It's because we throw the hardware away after each use. And so we need reusable rocket vehicles. And that's what Blue Origin is working on. We're working on making sure that we don't have to throw the plane away every time after you fly, you know, to your vacation destination. That would definitely increase the cost of your vacation. And so that's what we need to do. And we can do it. It's totally possible. And I think it's important. My view is that it's incredibly important work that needs to be done and done as quickly as possible. And I have my own reasons why I believe that. They can be explained pretty simply. And it's not, for me, it's not the, there's a very kind of common argument that's been around for a long time, actually kind of first popularized by Arthur C. Clarke, who said all civilizations become spacefaring or extinct. And this is the kind of plan B argument that, you know, when Earth is destroyed somehow, we better make sure that we don't have all of our eggs in one basket. And I hate the plan B argument. I think, you know, plan B with respect to Earth being destroyed is make sure plan A works. So we have sent robotic probes to every planet in this solar system. Believe me, this is the best one. We know that. It's not even close. You know, my friends who say they want to move to Mars or something, I say, like, why don't you go live in Antarctica for a year first? Because it's a garden paradise compared to Mars. And so we really, this planet is so amazing. It's a jewel in our solar system. And we have, if you take baseline energy usage on Earth and just compound it at a few percent a year for just a few hundred years, you have to cover the entire Earth's surface in solar cells. So that's not going to happen. So we have two choices. We either go out into space or we switch over to a civilization of stasis. And personally, I do not like the idea of stasis. You know, we have our grandchildren and their grandchildren will live in a much better world if they can continue to advance and develop and use more energy and all of the things that we've enjoyed for hundreds of years as a civilization of growth. I don't even really believe in stasis. I think things are either growing or shrinking. I think stasis is highly unusual and in real life doesn't exist. I don't even think liberty is consistent with the idea of stasis. I mean, if you get real stasis, somebody's going to have to tell you how many kids you can have, how much energy you can use. There'll be all kinds of things that just aren't consistent with liberty and freedom. So, but in space, we have, for all practical purposes, unlimited resources. We could have a trillion humans in the solar system and wouldn't be crowded. And so then if you had a trillion humans, you'd have 1,000 Einsteins and 1,000 Mozarts and 1,000 Da Vincis. And how cool would that be? But we have to go to space. And we have to go to space to save Earth. That's why this work is so important. And we don't have forever to do it. We've now gotten so big as a civilization on Earth that we kind of have to hurry. And so I believe that that really in a kind of a long time frame, the most important work I'm doing is Blue Origin and pushing forward to get humanity established in the solar system.
You know, it wasn't in this interview. I heard a different interview with him, and one of the things that he went into a little bit more depth on this narrative that he was talking there, and a lot of it revolved around the speed at which humans are consuming energy. And he started spouting off all the numbers, and he says, you know, in the last 10 years, the amount of energy that an individual human is using went up by this amount, and by whatever date, the energy consumption that we're going to need would pretty much have the whole planet covered in solar panels. And that's, so he kind of cut that piece of the narrative out, and it was a really interesting discussion that he said in a different interview. But that's what's really driving his narrative on why he thinks humans need to really kind of push outside the planet. I also find it interesting that I think Elon Musk would tell you almost the exact same narrative with respect to, you know, we've got to become a multi-planet or outside of the Earth type species in order to continue to exist if you're thinking anything outside of a couple hundred years from now. So, Brian, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, really two things, right? First of all, I like how, again, reframes the question. What's the thing that's keeping us from doing this? And it's a logistics problem, right? You reusing that aircraft. And so, again, can he leverage his platform to maybe solve that problem? And the other thing that that I heard as I listened to him talk was, I think he could have been answering the Washington Post question again, right? He says important work needs to be done. I could have heard him say, hey, am I going to wish at 80 years old that I hadn't done this or that sort of thing? I really think that he is thinking about long-term impacts and what he needs to do as being a good member of society.
So do you think that he got to that point because he's just worth so much money and it's kind of like, okay, so what do I do with my life at this point? Or do you think that Jeff Bezos was like this from day one? And I know there's no way to be able to answer that, but
it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? He's like above, off the chart. He is taking care of himself and family and roof and food and everything else. And so really he can look outside and how can he do the greatest good for the greatest number of people? And, I applaud people that do that sort of thing. And, many of the world's richest people are starting to think about that, how they can create a positive impact on society.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. I really like the discussion around this stuff. What I also find interesting, Brian, is that I believe he was the first one to land the rocket upright. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. I think most people would tell you that was Elon Musk, but it wasn't. In fact, I believe whenever Musk did land his rocket upright, Jeff Bezos sent him a tweet and said something to the tune of, "Hey man, welcome to the club."
Yeah, I think this just speaks to how those two gentlemen conduct themselves. You know, they're both doing very important things, but one chooses to do it more in the public eye than the other. And Jeff is just maybe a touch more quiet about it.
Yeah, Elon? I mean, he's just shooting his car into space. That's it.
it's some of the best marketing ever, right? That thing worth $80,000, and he got how many millions of dollars worth of free advertisement?
Oh, yeah. Hey, he's got to do something to keep that stock price propped up.
Talk about earning money and going after a loss for as long as possible, right? Probably a whole other interview we could talk about.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure that people listening to this, because you get people that are very polarized on that discussion. You got some diehard Tesla fans, and then you got some people saying it's going to, you know, get crushed. So we're not going to go down that path. We're just saying, you know, maybe it might be a little overvalued. We'll see. Brian, really enjoyed talking some of these points over with you. So I want to tell the audience, Brian, do you remember what episode it was that we talked about your business? I can't remember what episode number it was.
It's been a few months. I think it was 174. I was researching it the other day and looking at it. How long ago was that? I think it was January.
Something like that. We'll check it out. You might be right. It's 174, episode 174. We had Brian on the show, and he talked about his business. He has a business called Claudine Wines. That's Claudine Wines.com. It's the coolest business model. He does high-end wines at affordable prices, where he like buys barrels from Napa Valley, sends them out. But we talk about his business model on that episode. So if you're interested about this, go back, listen. Kind of, it's near the end of the episode, but he talks about his business. It's super cool. Check it out. I guarantee you it's going to be some of the best wine you drink. You know, shoot me a message. I'll forward it off to Brian if you enjoyed his wine. So, Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show and filling in for Stig. He's on his way to Denmark, and it's always great having you back on the show.
Preston, always a pleasure to chat. Let's do it again sometime.
Yep, absolutely. All right, so that's all we have for you guys on this week's episode of The Investors Podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to TIP. To access the show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. To get your questions played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com and win a free subscription to any of our courses on TIP Academy. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making investment decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the TIP Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting. TIP.